removed Donald Trump from office for inciting insurrection on 6th of January 2021. And also Governor Larry Hogan of Maryland, also a Republican, who called Friday a sad day for my party and the country. Republican National Committee members defended the measure, describing people who have been questioned by the January 6th committee as victims in a broader Democratic effort to keep focus on the attack at the Capitol. The nominal Republicans on the committee provide a pastiche of bipartisanship, but no genuine protection or due process for the ordinary people who did not riot, being targeted and terrorized by the committee, said Richard Porter, a Republican National Committee member from Illinois. Richard Porter added, "The investigation is a de facto Democrat-only investigation, increasingly unmoored from congressional norms." The January 6th committee, which has 7 Democratic members, has interviewed more than 475 witnesses, the vast majority of whom either volunteered to testify or agreed to without a subpoena. It has no prosecutorial powers and is charged with drawing up a report and producing recommendations to prevent anything similar from happening again. The party's far-right flank has long agitated to boot Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger out of the House Republican Conference for agreeing to serve on the panel, a push that Representative Kevin McCarthy of California, the minority leader in the House, has tried to brush aside. And a formal censure, approved by the state party chairs and committee members who make up the Republican National Committee, is sure to stir up those efforts again. We need to move on from that whole discussion and, frankly, move forward and get the House back in 2022, said Representative Mike Garcia, a California Republican facing a difficult re-election campaign in a newly configured district. Most House Republicans tried to ignore the actions of the party on Friday, refusing to answer questions or saying they had not read the censure resolution. Representative Dan Crenshaw, Republican of Texas, called it dumb stuff, while Representative Mark Green, Republican of Tennessee, lamented the distraction from this abysmal administration's record. Democrats, however, were incensed at the resolution's language. The Republican Party is so off the deep end now that they are describing an attempted coup and a deadly insurrection as political expression, said Representative Jamie Raskin, Democrat of Maryland and a member of the Special House Committee investigating the Capitol attack. Jamie Raskin added, "It is a scandal that historians will be aghast at to think that the major political party would be denouncing Liz Cheney for standing up for the Constitution and not saying anything about Donald Trump's involvement in the 6th of January insurrection." In his own defense, Adam Kinzinger said, "I have no regrets about my decision to uphold my oath of office and defend the Constitution. I will continue to focus my efforts on standing for the truth and working to fight the political matrix that's led us to where we find ourselves today." The resolution spoke repeatedly of party unity as the goal of censuring the lawmakers, saying the Republicans' ability to focus on the Biden administration was being sabotaged by the actions and words of Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, which indicate they support Democrat efforts to destroy President Trump more than they support winning back a Republican majority in 2022. Adam Kinzinger has already announced he will not seek re-election, as have some other House Republicans who voted to impeach Donald Trump for inciting the attack on the Capitol. Liz Cheney, however, has vowed to stand again for re-election. Earlier this week, the Wyoming delegation to the Republican National Committee submitted a so-called Rule 11 letter formalizing party support for Ms. Hageman. The existence of the letter was reported by the Washington Post. The letter allows the Republican National Committee to send resources to the Wyoming branch of the party to spend on Ms. Hageman's behalf, essentially designating her as the party's presumptive nominee. The designations are common in Republican politics, but typically are used to support incumbents who may be facing token primary challengers. Liz Cheney, who faces an uphill battle in her re-election bid against the Republican Party aligned with Donald Trump, said party leaders have effectively made themselves willing hostages to Donald Trump. "I do not recognize those in my party who have abandoned the Constitution to embrace Donald Trump," she said. "History will be their judge. I will never stop fighting for our constitutional republic, no matter what." Liz Cheney has a commanding financial advantage over Ms. Hageman, according to federal campaign finance reports released this week. Liz Cheney entered 2022 with nearly $5 million in campaign cash, while Ms. Hageman reported just $380,000. The censure resolution was watered down from initial version that called directly for the House Republican Conference to expel Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger without delay. That demand was dropped. However, the language condemning the attack on legitimate political discourse was then added. William Palatucci, a Republican National Committee member from New Jersey, who said he hoped the resolution, said those changes were made behind closed doors. Palatucci, who opposed the resolution, said the final language was officially circulated to committee members early on Friday morning. He called it cancel culture at its worst.
Midstream.
Step that came as a surprise with its implications and political dimensions, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad flew to the UAE on his first visit to an Arab country since the outbreak of the war imposed on Syria in 2011. President al-Assad met with Abu Dhabi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan, who stressed that Syria is a mainstay of Arab security and that the UAE is keen to strengthen cooperation with it. Mohammed bin Zayed declared that this visit comes within the framework of the common concern to continue consultation and fraternal coordination between the two countries on various issues. Then, in a statement that shocked Syria's enemies, Mohammed bin Zayed stressed that the UAE's position is consistent in its support for the territorial integrity and stability of Syria and the need for the withdrawal of all foreign forces illegally present on Syrian territory. For his part, President Assad stressed that the UAE is a country that has a great role with regard to the balanced policies it pursues towards international issues, pointing out that the world is changing and moving towards a state of instability. Therefore, in order to protect our region, we must continue to adhere to our principles, the sovereignty of our countries, and the interests of our peoples. Also, during his visit to the UAE, Assad met Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid, Vice President of the State and the ruler of Dubai. During the meeting, bin Rashid called for stability for the whole region and prosperity for all. The importance of this visit stems from the fact that this is the first of its kind. Add to that the development of Emirati and Syrian relations coinciding with the Emirati-Russian rapprochement and the visit of Abdullah bin Zayed to Moscow, and the UAE's rejection of an American request to increase oil production. The meeting is the latest in a series of diplomatic initiatives that point to a political shift in West Asia that is witnessing a number of Arab countries reviving their relations with Syria. Indications of rapprochement between Assad and Arab countries grew last week, including a phone call with Jordan's King Abdullah, who is also an ally of the United States. Meanwhile, the usual mood breaker came from the U.S. State Department, who still refuses to acknowledge Syria's victory in the U.S.-led regime change war that was launched 11 years ago. U.S. State Department spokesman Ned Price stated that Washington is deeply disappointed and disturbed by the invitation of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to visit the UAE, describing the invitation as an open attempt to legitimize the Syrian president. You know, because legitimacy only arises from the U.S. empire et al. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. President Bashar Assad, whose plane arrived last Friday at Dubai International Airport with a delegation accompanying him, which included Foreign Minister Faisal al-Miqdad, his deputy Bashar al-Ja'fari, and Minister of Presidential Affairs Mansour Azam, met upon his arrival the ruler of Dubai, Mohammed bin Rashid, his deputy Mansour bin Zayed, and advisor to the President of the Emirates, Anwar Gargash. Assad then met security figures before he met Abu Dhabi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed, his security advisor Tahnoon bin Zayed, and Minister of Foreign Affairs Abdullah bin Zayed. A one-day trip that was inclusive enough to raise eyebrows in Washington, which was very disappointed as per the Statement Department of State. Now, to discuss this issue with us from Damascus is Mr. Mohammed Abbas Mohammed, retired Syrian Army General and political analyst. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Mohammed. Now, in his first visit to an Arab country since the launch of the global war against Syria in 2011, President Bashar al-Assad flew to Dubai last week and met literally with everyone in just one day. Now, a lot of questions may arise from this visit, but the most important one for now is, what does this visit mean both at the regional and the international level?
In fact, this visit constitutes a qualitative leap in Syrian-Arab relations, especially with the United Arab Emirates. At a time when Syria faced a long war of aggression and also faced American terrorism that wanted to undermine the Syrian government and the Syrian state. Today, this visit constitutes a stabilizing factor and paves the way for stability in the region and for an effective role for the UAE in restoring stability, both at the internal level inside Syria or at the level of interrelationships in the West Asia region, especially since the aggression against Syria has led to seismic shifts in the region and ruined many relations for Syria. It harmed the security and stability of the region in all its social, economic, cultural, political, and humanitarian dimensions, especially in the security and military dimensions. Therefore, this visit establishes a major role for the UAE to strengthen the Arab bond and to give the Emirates an opportunity for constructive cooperation with Syria, thus establishing a positive Syrian-Emirati role in the region as a whole, especially in supporting the Syrian economy. This visit also has positive indications for strengthening Syria's future role in the Arab League and in its relationship with all Arab countries in the region.
Well, Mr. Mohammed, the U.S. was not happy at all with this visit, and it was evident in the U.S. State Department's statement in which they expressed deep disappointment and alarm at Assad's visit to the UAE, stressing their rejection of what they described as a clear attempt to legitimize President Assad and his Syrian government. I mean, this visit was anticipated, especially after the rapprochement that happened between the UAE and Syria back in November 2021. So what is the Biden administration actually trying to convey here?
The U.S. administration can only imagine itself as the one who dominates this world. America always says that all states should perceive the world the way the Americans see it exclusively. Thus, we see a change and a new position for the Emirates for almost the first time. We see that it took the decision on its own to communicate with the Syrian government and renew its relations with the Syrian state, regardless of the American position. The UAE position has been clear since the Emirates opened its embassy in Syria, and since it strengthened these relations with the visit of UAE foreign minister to Damascus. And thus, this relationship culminated in an official visit by President Bashar al-Assad to the Emirates. Regardless of the nature of frustration and despair on the part of the U.S. administration, especially as we see countries that were considered among America's allies in the region that have stood up and taken their decisions away from American hegemony. This also indicates a change in the relationship between the countries that were considered puppets for the Americans. We see them now return to their Arab orbit. We remember well that UAE's position from the Russian military operation in Ukraine, as this stance was inconsistent with the American position. And from here, we can conclude that new variables have begun to emerge in the region in general.
Well, Mr. Mohammed, many observers believe that the importance of this rapprochement is that it breaks the collar of isolation between Damascus and the rest of the Arab world, especially the surroundings of Syria. Yet we also heard many anti-Syrian government commentators saying that this step might bring Syria closer to a normalization with the Zionist entity. Literally just 1 week after the Zionist entity actually bombed Syrian territories. How do you assess such a claim?
The Zionist entity is constantly trying to exert military pressure on the armed terrorist groups in Syria. But I do not think that Syria will succumb to the aggression, because Syria has only one compass that points to the Arab city of Al-Quds. Syria has a compass towards the Golan and the restoration of the occupied Arab Golan. Syria will not give up its rights for its territory and sovereignty, and therefore the attempts that aim to distort or demonize the Syrian rule or provide false information are in fact no more than propaganda to distort and only to incite against the Syrian state. By saying that normalization exists between the occupation entity and the Syrian state, in fact, Syria has not changed its position and has not relinquished its national sovereign decisions. Also, Syria is keen to strengthen its relations with the Arab countries, which in turn adhere to the active Syrian role. When Israel carries out these continuous attacks, it will not achieve results. The only result that the occupying entity must realize is that the Golan Heights will return to Syria, regardless of the circumstances, and the existence of the Zionist entity is only temporary.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Mr. Mohammed Abbas Mohammed, retired Syrian Army General and political analyst, for joining us to talk about this very important development in West Asia. Thank you very much for your time. And please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about the Iranian strike against Erbil.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Well, the Iranian response to the recent attacks carried out by the Zionist entity agreed new messages and major changes at the strategic level in light of the international transformations, whether at the level of the Ukrainian crisis or the Vienna negotiations related to the agreement on the Iranian nuclear program. The strategic patience that the Republic relied on in the region has become among the variables, as the assassination of Iranian Revolutionary Guard officers in Syria, the launching of drones from Erbil towards Iranian military bases, or the establishment of bases for operating Mossad agents and recruiting them to cause sabotage operations in the Islamic Republic, has become unacceptable. After the Iranian response, the above was placed within the red lines that will not be allowed to be crossed. More in this following report.
The missile strike adopted by the Iranian Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps in an official statement, which targeted a strategic intelligence center of the Zionist Mossad in the Iraqi city of Erbil, came to reaffirm the interdependence of all international events in this transitional and pivotal stage in human history. About a month after the Mossad's involvement in an undeclared aggression against a drone site affiliated with the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps in the Iranian province of Kermanshah, Iran targeted a house in the city of Erbil, located near the American consulate, owned by an Iraqi businessman, but was used by the Zionist intelligence service. The house was a strategic center to lead the Mossad's sabotage operations against Iran and the region. The Islamic Revolutionary Guard statements said that it targeted a Zionist center with precision missiles. The Iranian Tasnim news agency reported that the Revolutionary Guards used 10 Fateh 110 precision ballistic missiles in the attack, and that the missiles were launched from the northwestern region of Iran. The missile strike destroyed the targeted center, killing 4 Mossad officers and wounding 7 others, 4 of whom were seriously injured, according to the information available to Iranian intelligence after the strike. The timing of the strike spoke directly to Americans, who had recently been slow to accept Iran's conditions for returning to the nuclear agreement, indicating that Iran's missile defense program is non-negotiable and that it will not return to complying with the terms of the nuclear agreement except within its strict conditions related to lifting all American sanctions, including those imposed on the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps. It is also difficult to separate the timing of the missile attack from the interactions of the war in Ukraine, as Moscow recently demanded the U.S. to provide additional guarantees related to ensuring that the new U.S. sanctions on Russia do not affect its trade dealings with Iran in the event of a return to the nuclear agreement. The timing of this strike is also an indirect assertion of Iran's strategic alliance with Russia as part of the battle to break American hegemony. As for the temporary Zionist Israeli entity, the main target of this strike, the style and place of the attack were a clear message on the readiness of the Iranian deterrent force in its confrontation, especially that the entity was subjected to a cyber attack, which was described as the largest Israel has ever been subjected to. This strike was also a warning to neighboring countries of the Arab Zionist camp that recently took a ride in the Israeli train of normalization, a notice that their lands will not be immune from strong military strikes if they make it a springboard for any Zionist aggression targeting the Islamic Republic.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Laith Maarouf, political commentator. Thank you for joining us, Laith. Now, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps took responsibility for firing 12 ballistic missiles at what it referred to as a strategic center for Zionist conspiracy and evil in Erbil. Now, Israel is still in shock after also enduring a cyber attack that is said to be the largest it has ever faced. How do you assess all of these Iranian strategic messages to the Zionist entity?
It's very important and actually groundbreaking. It's changing now the rules of engagement between the axis of resistance and the Zionist colony. It shows also that, given that this comes 2 years after the assassination of General Soleimani and the strong response by the Iranian military to that assassination, that not only is it that the United States will not respond when it's attacked by Iran, which means that this is a change in the world, but also right now with this attack on the Mossad offices in Erbil, shows that Iran is willing to go far and attack the Zionist colony. And as we see right now, nobody from the imperialist camp came to the aid of these Zionists. So now we have a change in the parameters of engagement in all of West Asia, which is accelerating as we see the Americans are withdrawing. They tried to leave behind them a local mini NATO that brings together the Gulf countries and the apartheid colony. And as we see this new military alliance between these Gulf monarchies and the Zionists, is not going to bring any security to any of them. Therefore, the future that we can predict is more bold moves by the resistance axis and more retreat by the vessels of the United States.
Well, Laith, the Kurds have decades of established ties with Israel that date back to the 1950s, which has included covert military training as well. Now, but Iraqi law prohibits relations with the Israeli entity, restrictions that were fortified last year after a highly publicized pro-Israel event in Erbil fell flat on its face. But did the government in Baghdad not know about the activity of the Mossad in Erbil? And do you think that Iran is holding the official Iraqi government responsible for allowing such a major breach?
Well, first off, we have to acknowledge that there is no actual state in Iraq because what makes a state is a monopoly over the use of force in your territory, control of the economy and the finances. And as we know, Iraq has no the military of Iraq has no monopoly over the use of force in its territory, and the resources of Iraq are looted, and the money of the state is disappeared. So what we know really that is what's on the ground is the Kurdish regions that are out of control of the central government, and as of yet, the military of Iraq has not been able to expand its control of the territory. There's at least 24 Turkish occupation bases in the north of Iraq. So this is without even talking about the American occupation and so forth. So what does this mean? That means that the oil of Iraq from the north is looted and disappeared by the Kurdish contras that control the Kurdish regions. And the authorities in Baghdad have no control of the collaboration between the Turkish, the Kurdish leadership and the Zionists. And that is why Iran took this drastic measure of asserting its security in Erbil, because the government in Baghdad is not able to guarantee the security of Iran by itself over its what is supposed to be part of Iraq. So in the next few months, as the government in Baghdad continues to not be formulated, we're still waiting to know who's the president or the prime minister of the country months after the election. As this vacuum continues to not be filled, it is the priority of Iran and the axis of resistance to make sure that Iraq is not used as a territory, as a springboard for attacks on Syria or attacks on Iran.
Which is why the Iranians are dead set on establishing deterrence and have for a few years now warned that they would deliver an equal ratio of counterattacks to Israeli salvos, whether at sea or on land, for that matter. But on Sunday, they warned that the next attack on Israeli operations will be and I quote, harsh, decisive, and destructive response. Is that an indication of a possible imminent retaliation to Israel's recent aggression on Syria, which targeted Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps fighters?
Oh, yes. I mean, everybody in the Zionist colony are waiting, on one and a half legs, as Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah would say, for the response of Iran and Syria to that attack south of Damascus that led to the martyrdom of Syrian officers and Iranian officers. So this is coming 100%, and all of the Zionists are waiting for it. Their military is on the highest alert. Their air defenses are on the highest alert in the north of occupied Palestine and the Golan Heights. And everybody in the region should expect it to come. Now, what does this mean, and what will be the result of the response of Syria and Iran? This is all up to, it's impossible to predict. But we know also Ramadan is coming. There's expected some increase of violence in Palestine,
yeah,
just
we
like
last
year.
Exactly, May of last year in Ramadan.
And we have the elections.
Operation.
And we have the elections in Lebanon coming up in a few months. So all of these events will unfold in the next 2 months, and all of them could be a trigger to a regional battle. And as the resistance in Yemen continues to punish the Saudis and the Emiratis for their war crimes in Yemen, again, all of these are related. The battle zone of Western Asia is now all open, and the battle scenes are all connected. Mm-hmm. And we should expect, either that the Zionists will take the punch and absorb it and not retaliate, and or we're ready for a regional war.
Well, very exciting and anticipating times we live in, Mr. Daith. I know people might think that this sounds crazy, but it's about time we put an end to the apartheid colony, as you named it. Thank you very much, Laith Maru, for joining us to talk about the latest Iranian strike on a Mossad unit in Erbil. Thank you. And please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East stream. See you next week.
Congratulations to all Iranians and everyone who celebrates the ancient festivity of Nowruz.
Limelight.
Ex-whistleblower Everett Stern, who talked to the 6th of January panel, said FBI agents and the House panel investigating the 6th of January attack on the Capitol have both learned of a plan by allies of retired Army General Michael Flynn to gather intelligence on top U.S. Republicans to move them to back election audits in key states that Donald Trump lost. We now present you an article written by Peter Stone. The piece is titled, Michael Flynn Allies Plotted to Lean on U.S. Republicans to Back Vote Audits. Ex-whistleblower Everett Stern, who talked to the 6th of January panel, said FBI agents and the House panel investigating the 6th of January attack on the Capitol have both learned of a plan by allies of retired Army General Michael Flynn to gather intelligence on top Republicans to move them to back election audits in key states that Donald Trump lost. Everett Stern, who runs the intelligence firm Tactical Rabbit, and is a Republican vying for a Senate seat in Pennsylvania, in multiple interviews with The Guardian, said two Flynn associates with the right-wing Patriot Caucus group enlisted his help in April in a scheme to seek potentially damaging information on two Republican members of Congress to prod them to back an audit of the 2020 presidential election that Joe Biden won. Everett Stern told The Guardian he spent several hours in November telling House panel investigators about the drive by Michael Flynn associates who sought campaign finance and other dirt on Pennsylvania Senator Pat Toomey and Congressman Brian Fitzpatrick to win their support for an audit to bolster Donald Trump's debunked charges that Joe Biden's win was fraudulent. A long-shot candidate to succeed the retiring Pat Toomey, Everett Stern said he alerted the FBI in June when he heard more details of the bizarre drive by Michael Flynn allies to specifically target the two Republicans, both of whom backed impeaching Trump after the 6th of January insurrection. The efforts by Michael Flynn's Patriot Caucus allies were launched after Donald Trump failed to block Joe Biden from taking office and are part of a wider drive by Trump loyalists and Michael Flynn to help boost Trump's political fortunes via more state audits nationwide into charges that Biden's win was rigged and elect like-minded candidates in key states to top electoral offices. Everett Stern provided text messages, emails, and other documents revealing he had multiple contacts with one of the Patriot Caucus members, Velma Ann Ruth, and two other influential Flynn allies, Houston real estate mogul Al Hartman and former Army Green Beret Ivan Raiklin, who were pushing audits in several key states. Everett Stern said Michael Flynn's Patriot Caucus associates first approached him in Pennsylvania for possible help after an April Republican Party event, and soon after told Stern in phone calls they worked with Michael Flynn and the Patriot Caucus and planned to recruit former domestic and foreign intelligence officials to facilitate their scheme. The plan by Michael Flynn allies alarmed Everett Stern, but as a former whistleblower involved in exposing a large bank money laundering scandal by HSBC in 2012, he told The Guardian he decided to play along for a few months to glean information to expose the Trump allies' scheme. Everett Stern expressed dismay that Flynn's Patriot Caucus associates don't understand that Biden is the president. They wanted to collect information through Tactical Rabbit and my campaign to turn up the heat on Pat Toomey and Fitzpatrick to back an audit which Stern viewed as potentially extortion. Everett Stern gave The Guardian a voicemail he received in which Al Hartman talked about leaning on moderate Republican rhinos in Pennsylvania to gain support for an audit of that state's vote, with Joe Biden won by over 80,000 votes, and Al Hartman said a similar drive in Michigan was needed. Everett Stern said Al Hartman wanted to use Tactical Rabbit's intelligence gathering tools and his campaign to dig up potentially embarrassing campaign finance information and other dirt about the Pennsylvania members, plus Republican political figures in Michigan who were also resisting audits. Everett Stern said Al Hartman and Raiklin also talked with Stern about meeting Flynn, Trump's disgraced former national security advisor, and proposed compensating him for his information via campaign donations. In an April exchange of Al Hartman text messages seen by The Guardian, Al Hartman asked a Michael Flynn scheduler to help connect Flynn with Everett Stern, whose Senate campaign and credentials he touted highly, calling Stern a strong believer in their cause. Although Everett Stern tipped off the FBI in June about what he deemed a threat to national security, and he said he met with agents again in November, it's not clear if his charges are still being pursued. Everett Stern's charges have echoes of Michael Flynn's scheming with Donald Trump and other loyalists in late 2020 to thwart Joe Biden's win, efforts that included a White House meeting with Trump where Michael Flynn proposed declaring martial law in several states that Joe Biden won and then rerunning the election in those states. According to an Arizona Senate document shared by the watchdog group American Oversight to coordinate national efforts, Raiklin and Hartman on 3rd of July spearheaded one of a series of election integrity calls with Trump loyalists, lawyers and donors to discuss the status of audit efforts in several states and other plans to cast doubt on Joe Biden's win. The Arizona document reads, "Join us every second Saturday for situation updates and collaboration from active leaders in the election remediation process at state level. Attorneys with Mike Lindell and Patrick Byrne, data analysts, state legislators, gubernatorial candidates, and grassroots activists whose goal is completing a cyber forensic audit in their state." A who's who list of Trump loyalists and groups invited to join these calls included the America Project and America's Future, both of which Michael Flynn played key roles with as they poured some $2 million into a discredited audit of Arizona's largest county. Plus the Patriot Caucus, Velma and Ruth, Fincham and Byrne, the millionaire chief financier of the Arizona audit. Al Hartman, in emails with Everett Stern obtained by The Guardian, invited him in June to attend a religious far-right meeting known as Ziklag in Dallas, Texas, where he could meet separately with Michael Flynn. Everett Stern said Al Hartman told him a private meeting was going to be arranged with Michael Flynn, who Stern was told wanted to meet him. After indicating to Al Hartman he would attend, Everett Stern opted to cancel at the last minute, after his lawyer indicated there could be legal repercussions from such a meeting. Al Hartman has long been a donor to the right. He is on the advisory council for the pro-Trump Turning Point USA and has been active in the conservative donor network led by oil billionaire Charles Koch. According to a military official who spoke to the Reuters news agency recently, Ray Klin, an Army Reserve officer who reportedly has known Michael Flynn since 2014, is facing an internal Army Reserve investigation into possible violations of rules barring partisan political activity. Reuters has reported Ray Klin in December of 2020 outlined a wild scheme in tweets and a podcast to thwart Joe Biden's win, charging a vast conspiracy theory that included Pence, intelligence, China, and big tech. Ray Klin told Donald Trump to activate the emergency broadcast system and deployed the hashtag #FightLikeAFlynn, stressing that we the people are going to force this plan on them. Neither Al Hartman or Ray Klin replied to multiple calls seeking comment. A Flynn scheduler did not respond to questions for the story. Velma Ann Ruth, with the Patriot Caucus, who was photographed with Everett Stern at a June event in Pennsylvania, said General Michael Flynn called Stern's charges delusional, fabricated, and defamatory. In a text message, Everett Stern said he shared the photo and other documents involving exchanges he had with Velma Ann Ruth with the FBI. Senior former prosecutors and intelligence officials say Everett Stern's charges merit law enforcement attention. Former prosecutor Paul Rosenzweig, who worked on Ken Starr's team during the impeachment of Bill Clinton, said Everett Stern's charges suggest serious crimes. If his allegations were corroborated by extrinsic evidence, they clearly would warrant an investigation. Defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Tick, 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 and a few shots, and there it is. The Iranian post-Islam solar calendar turns 15 centuries and a year old, March the 20th, most years March the 21st. The occasion, however, goes way back to the 6th century before Christ or so, when Iran was Zoroastrian. But the tradition continues in its time-adapted form with Qurans on the New Year or Hafsin table.
New Year's the deal, everywhere. And Iran's is when all comes to life, first of spring, with roots in antiquity. What better place to do a piece on it than one of Tehran's prominent museums? Except it's hard to tell which is overwhelming. The ancient tradition Nowruz, literally New Day or New Year, or this glassware museum with objects 2-3 times as old as Nowruz itself, possibly. For more on this tradition and how it's being handled in today's economy, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today.
Local musicians call in Nowruz, piping and beating on tambourines to a local tune, most prominently in Damavand and Mazandaran province. Each locality welcomes in the rolling spring with a slightly different flavor. And by locality, I don't just mean different provinces of Iran. Peoples and countries stretched across the Silk Route have celebrated Nowruz from olden days when Iranian ways and beliefs stretched far and wide. Now, over 300 million people over these countries are celebrating the tradition. At the Glassware or Abgina Museum, I got to talk to the Cultural Heritage Organization chief, Mr. John Fishon.
Nowruz is an ancient tradition of ours that marks the start of the solar year. It's celebrated in several Asian countries. Nowruz marks a change in nature and also a change in the personal lives of people when the new year arrives. This is both a physical and spiritual change. Therefore, Nowruz may be the only tradition in the world that starts at the beginning of the year when the spring comes and the nature renews itself. What I think is very important is that we have unique historical and cultural tourism in Iran. One of these holidays is our Nowruz holidays. These are part and parcel of our religion and civilization and the roots of a nation.
As the cold and dark peel off to give way to sunny spring, the Hafsin or Seven Scenes table displays objects symbolizing purity, brightness, abundance, happiness and fertility for the new year. Each of the seven objects start with the letter S or Sin in Persian. I'll bring you back to the table. But first, a little on how people have managed to do their New Year shopping next to setting their tables with prices going through the roof, given inflation stands at a 40% high, no less, and local currency at a low of 260 to 70,000 rials to the dollar. Mr. Mojtabai is Secretary General to the Iran Chamber of Guilds. It was a pleasure to have him, although on Skype.
You see, according to the decision of the Supreme Employment Council, the minimum wage increased by about 57%, while the average wages were raised by 38%, as about 2 million tumans are considered as supplementary benefits to the base salaries. On average, we can say that average wages are up by 47% this year. This means that on average, the cost for the workforce in the economic activities, including production, distribution and services, will be up by 47% alone. This is a pretty substantial sum because in our economy, the prices are determined by the cost of the workforce rather than the technology behind the production.
Well, public and government assistance to low-income families is high on the government's agenda, but the situation is dire with ready money at a low. Given U.S. sanctions and domestic long-term mismanagement and corruption.
We are dealing with the issue of the allocation of subsidized foreign reserves to different goods, whether or not it has to be removed altogether at the same time or gradually, or if we can remove it for target groups. The government is making these policies to control the prices. In the year 1400, we implemented the policy of value-added tax, which even applied to basic goods. But the heads of the three branches of the government repealed the law for basic goods to prevent the prices from soaring.
The government tripled cash handouts as it multiplied the number of households receiving them for the new year. But a cash handout of 1.5 million rials is no match for a 40% inflation and transgressional prices. The draft budget bill for this Persian year in 2022 was presented in December 2021 by the President Raisi to Parliament or Majlis. In that $864 billion bill, production and employment are the pivots. This is ironic, as it is a fat government's expenses that have caused much of the cash shortage in the country and therefore minting unbacked money, which led to higher inflation. But Raisi's presidency is new and he doesn't appear eager to carry on with the policies inherited from presidents past. Mr. Bakhtiari is chief of the Imam Khomeini Relief Foundation. He gave us some of his time via Skype.
Imam Khomeini Relief Foundation has been evaluating employment conditions and requirements for some 350 cities. Lately, in cooperation with the Islamic Azad University, we've been evaluating even more cities and identified jobs that would result in sustainable income for every city, and started to plan skill learning courses with the help from Iran's Technical and Vocational Training Organization. I see a bright future for employment, entrepreneurship, and production across the cities and villages.
In his new draft budget bill, public resources are estimated at 13.72 quadrillion rials, which is over $326.5 billion, and the government's budget at about under $358.5 billion, with an increase of 9.2% compared to the Iranian year past, the year 1400, that is. Revenues from exporting oil, gas, and gas condensate are estimated at under $91 billion. That's 8.5% more than the figure in last Iranian year's budget. Tax and customs incomes are predicted at under $134 billion. That's a 73% rise from last year, and it has caused much frustration at the thought that the government will try to make up for official inefficiency and corruption by dipping into the pockets of the people. People assembling to help those in need is a tradition here, but on a voluntary basis, with the government just rallying volunteers.
People spending in Nowruz, 1399 and 1400 was at its lowest. The same was true over the past 2 years, too. Businesses haven't been so prosperous. Thankfully, in the days leading up to the Nowruz this year, there has been a new upturn for businesses. From a few months ago, the production sector saw a boost in manufacturing goods for the new year, including clothing such as shoes and bags, nuts, decorations, furniture, curtains, and others. The production is still lower than before the pandemic began, but it's been significantly better compared to the past 2 years. Thankfully, there is a new economic activity led by these businesses, and we hope that it would result in the prosperity of businesses and the creation of job opportunities in all trade and industrial sectors.
Raisi appears to choose pragmatism over compassion to steer administrative measures toward longer-term improvements. So while stressing Islamic society should be governed on the basis of social justice, he said, the reform of structures and indicators takes precedence over the care of the poor and needy. But at the same time, with the implementation of long-term and structural programs and measures, the poor and needy must be treated with dignity and urgent plans to eliminate absolute poverty.
One of our programs for the new year is to create 500,000 jobs. Thankfully, the parliament has allocated 25 billion tumans as zero-interest lending to Imam Khomeini's Relief Foundation. God willing, we can accomplish our mission with the help of the central bank and other operating banks. Some ask whether the employment benefits are only for those under the coverage of the Relief Foundation. The answer is that although those covered take priority, those who need help, even if they're not covered, will be assisted and will receive employment benefits. Our priorities are those living in villages.
To address the poor and needy, the president's measures are to update the Welfare and Social Security Comprehensive Information System and to make use of people's capacities in planning and providing public assistance. In other words, burden sharing with the government, which the people did do in the early days of the corona pandemic.
In addition to the very important discussion of employment, we have an important program called vocational and skills training which precedes employment. Those who take the course take priority in receiving the zero-interest loans. Therefore, we've signed a memorandum of understanding with the Ministry of Cooperatives, Labor, and Social Welfare, and the Technical and Vocational Training Organization a month ago to create such training programs for 500,000 people. The MO also requires 12,000 units in the private sector to join the programs. The Technical and Vocational Training Organization itself has 450 training centers which will also be used under the Memorandum of Understanding.
Time for another use of nature, papermaking and reading, as I invite you to take a look at what other media sources have to say. Our news of the day is basically New Year messages from the leaders of the country focusing on domestic production as a means of improving the economy. The Tehran Times quotes the leader, who titles New Year as a year of production, knowledge-based and job-creating. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, addressed the nation on the occasion of the Iranian New Year, March the 20th, 2022, felicitating the nation on the occasion of Nowruz and calling on the government and nation to work hard to boost knowledge-based production and create new jobs. The leader re-emphasized the importance of boosting domestic production as he had done in past years, saying the reason he placed so much emphasis on it is because it boosts economic growth, creates employment, reduces inflation, increases per capita income, and improves public welfare. Furthermore, it also brings about psychological effects since it boosts national self-confidence and creates a sense of dignity in the nation. Production is such an elixir. National production is this important if it is carried out, of course, in the best possible way, God willing. Ayatollah Khamenei designated the new Iranian calendar year of 1401 as the year of production, knowledge-based and job-creating. Mehr News quotes the president, Iran's economy not to be left in limbo pending of JCPOA, stating that the country and economy would not be left in limbo pending the conclusion of the JCPOA. The president said that while engaging in Vienna negotiations, the government put its focus on thwarting sanctions. He made the remarks in his New Year message aired live from the Grand Mosque of the southwestern Iranian port city Khorramshahr on Sunday evening, March the 20th. My first Nowruz message as the servant of the public is the message of round-the-clock and incessant work to build a powerful and advanced Iran, he said. No nation and no country has achieved anything without intensive work and the maximum use of human and natural resources. The new year and the new century should be the beginning of a new era of productive, useful, fruitful and progressive work for us all. During the current year, God willing, the issue of employment will be our first and foremost issue, Iran's president said, adding that unemployment is the root cause of all economic and social plights. As a result, he noted, supporting domestic production is at the top of his administration's agenda. That'll be it for the news section today.
Raisi, heading the Islamic Republic's 13th government, spoke at its first meeting of the Supreme Council of Welfare and Social Security. That's when and where the Minister of Labor, Cooperation and Social Welfare presented a report on the welfare of Iranian households in terms of income, education, health, housing, access to water and energy facilities and infrastructure. And his ministry was assigned to prepare a comprehensive poverty alleviation program with the cooperation of other agencies and present it at the Council's next meeting. Also, a program was approved to combat child malnutrition. The country has a rich 2-3-pronged budget to dip into for damage control. Apart from an oil budget that has shrunken thanks to sanctions on exports and consequential smuggling, with oil revenues lost in exchanges off the books, there is money from foundations originally established to provide for the needy by different means. A generally preferred means being the generation of money by business to give 50% to the poor and to put 50% into or back into industry and business to regenerate yet more for the poor.
Now it's a lot of money to handle, and where individuals get involved, funds can go mismanaged. Even management needs supervision, which is the case also with corona combating policies. How's that relevant here?
Well, while Persians' purchasing power may be wanting, the average traveler carrying dollars to this country can buy 10 items for one. The variety of handicrafts is mind-boggling, as is the wealth of historic and architectural sites and geological geographic sites and multicolored customs and clothes in this four-season mini-continent, Iran. All wonders have come together here, and it's still cheap.